The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kurt Benroot from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sci-Fi. For the next half hour, we will be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi.
Hi, I'm Susie Pratt, and this is Keeping House by Mary Soon Lee. In a well-run household, such matters as laundry and dusting and the scouring of pots need not concern the mistress of the establishment. Discarded silk robes will discreetly wriggle their way to the washing tub. Each morning after breakfast, the soap will jump in, and the garments will scrub each other. If on occasion the younger ones splash over-vigorously, excited by the bubbles, their elders will calm them. The cook prepares the meals, but neither lays the table nor cleans up afterward. Chopsticks and china proceed to their accustomed places beforehand, then move to the kitchen at the meal's conclusion. There they line up, pots to the rear. In our household, the oldest brush supervises. His bristles are frayed, his handle is worn, he no longer enters the sink, yet even the rowdiest platters hush when he speaks. Hanging from his cook, he directs the entire operation, from the heating of the water to the polishing of the tea bowls. It is veterans such as this who govern the household. My great-great-great-grandmother's bronze phoenix lamp is the undisputed matriarch of our home. During the day, she hurries from room to room. No speck of dust escapes her attention. No rug dares to rumple itself. At night, she positions herself by the pool in the inner courtyard, her reflection bobbing in the water beside the mirrored moon. When I have difficulty sleeping, I join her by the pool. In spring, the sweet scent of azalea blossom is a counterpoint to her sharp wit. In autumn, the maple leaves twirl in the wind. In winter, I sip warmed wine while she recites a poem by Li Bai. Household items serve from an innate sense of place, of duty. They never ask for payment, will not even ask for repairs on their own behalf, though they may mention if a colleague is chipped or torn. Do not take such service for granted. Bow your thanks for any task particularly well done. Our housewares are partial to flowers, so I visit the market twice a month, returning with potted peonies or late autumn chrysanthemums. On tomb sweeping day, I burn offerings for their ancestors as well as my own. Ghost money, paper flowers, in memory of chairs and cushions and vases long since gone.
This story is called Mercy by Marie Ness. In the end, they did not shut the princess up alone. It had been discussed, but a few of the advisers of the king's court had seen prisoners dragged from their cells after years of speaking to no one but their guards, if that. Prisoners who had not seen the sun. The princess was disobedient, yes, but she could still be useful, perhaps, if she was not driven insane. If she still had some capacity for human speech. If she could be reminded that she was still a princess. No, she would not be imprisoned in the darkness alone. That left the choice of her companion. A member of the nobility, one familiar with the proper manners that the princess would need to maintain afterwards, would be the best, and certainly the court had more than enough duchesses and countesses of questionable virtue whose imprisonments would be, well, perhaps not justified, but understandable. On the other hand, many of these ladies had powerful relatives or could potentially be useful, politically at least. No one wanted to chance losing that. And of course, such ladies, even those in royal service, would know nothing of the daily chores of caring for a princess. Not that these chores would be all that burdensome in the five tiny rooms, in the dark, without a single hint of sun or stars. But still, appearances had to be maintained. A servant, then, but not too lowly of one. Again, appearances had to be maintained, and the princess could not be allowed to coarsen her speech in the interim, especially since she would not be allowed books, The king had forbidden that, and in any case, fires and candles were hardly safe in a prison without windows. Eventually they found one, a maid who had been caught playing with the jewelry of a countess. To clean it, the maid said. But the countess claimed that her jewels needed no cleaning. It was enough. They congratulated themselves on their mercy, then pushed the princess in gently, and the maid after her less gently. The princess screamed, a last farewell to her prince, perhaps. The maid did not. She had never met a prince, perhaps. It was discussed, of course, in whispers, with some speaking of the hardened emotions of maids, and others knowing something of the princes of the court and the maids, keeping their silence. But soon the court had other concerns. War, pestilence, famine, the last two, not touching the court very much, projected as they were behind walls and gardens and coin, but still matters to be discussed. And if, years later, they found themselves locked in their own luxurious rooms, unable to emerge, their cries for food and water growing weaker each day, well, they never blamed it on mercy. After all, they told themselves, they had received none.
Hi, this is Catherine Laughlin, and I'm going to be reading today Rock, Paper, Scissors, Glass by Jude Marie Green. Aunt Tad lounged on the porch swing, half in and half out of the sun. I brought her some lemonade because I was thirsty and hot, sweating through my shirt. She didn't sweat. She waved her hand slowly through the beams of sunlight, admiring the rainbows they painted on the floorboards. "Most people cast shadows," she said. "I shed refractions. It's kind of odd, but you get used to it." She took the lemonade in her glass hand. She wore a tank top and abbreviated shorts, leaving nothing to the imagination, really. Glass skull, no hair, of course. Glass bones and skin. Glass chest rising smoothly with her breath. Transparent everywhere except for some discreet cloudy spot shielding her internal organs. I sat next to her on the swing, squinting to see where the glass of the lemonade disappeared against the transparency of her hand and her lips. "I guess you'll know soon enough," she said. "Your mom says you want to join up, take on the change, go into battle as an amorphous?" I nodded. "Yes, I have to serve. I might as well serve with the best and the most beautiful," I thought. But I'd already blurted out that I thought she was beautiful, and she'd ignored me. Aunt Tad stretched like a cat. I heard dangerous crackling from her spine. "She wants me to talk you out of it." She pointed her face at me with a considering silence. I'd expected this. "I already signed up. I don't know why she doesn't want me to be on the elite team."
"You don't?"
"I know you heard me last night. I shattered glass with my screams." She waggled her feet. Three toes were missing from the right, two from the left. I gasped. "No worries, sweetie. I have a repair kit. I even picked up some dichromatic glass. Some decoration is allowed these days." "Can I watch?" The word slipped out and I blushed. "She's my aunt," I thought furiously. "Not a curiosity. Not a thing to observe." She snorted. "Maybe. You know, your mom and I fought over getting into the amorphous. We both had the scores, but they said only one of us could join. Only one opening, they said. So we settled the issue with a rousing game of rock, paper, scissors, a strategy game as old as time." "But that game is always a tie," I blurted. "You're thinking of tic-tac-toe," she said. Was that disappointment in her voice? My face heated up. "That nice blush will go away after the change, you know." She smoothed my cheek with her fingers, which weren't cold at all. I thought they'd be cold. "I'm so proud that I beat your mom 2-1. I'm not sure why she threw the tiebreaker to me, but she did." She sat up straight and pushed the swing into motion with her damaged foot. "Say, want to play a game or two?" "I won't throw them to you," I said. "Of course not. 1, 2, 3. I held out my fist. Rock. She held out her fist, too. Tie, I said. Rock smashes rock. No, my fist is glass. When we touch rock, our nanos disintegrate the material. Rock feeds us. Enemies can't hide from us in caves. I win. I almost said, that's cheating. But I didn't. That's how she wanted to play it. I'd play along. Okay. 1, 2, 3, she said again. I held out my palm, paper. She held out her own palm. I win, I said, paper wraps glass. I win, she said, glass shreds paper. We aren't little tame blown glass figurines. We drop over the enemy and shiver off flechettes of glass. Flesh doesn't stand a chance with us, nor clothes, no armor. Better than bullets, that's what my sergeant said. Her eyes clouded over. Fields of blood and glass. I thought about this. But doesn't that make you the perfect weapon? Killing the enemy, isn't that the idea? She shook her head. Winning, that's the idea. Killing is a strategy. One more, I said, and counted. 1, 2, 3. I put my fingers out as scissors. She left her hands down. I win, I crowed. Want to play 4 out of 5? She shook her head. The only way to win is to not play. But I like to play. And your mom won. She has you. I grasped her clear, warm hand. Not for long.
I'm Warren Keyes, and I'm going to be reading Breath, written by Chelsea Berghofer. I never knew I could hold my breath for so long. But every time I heard the door open, every time the footsteps came towards me, time felt slower. The footsteps took longer to hit the floor, and my breath took twice as much time to go in and out of my lungs. I didn't want to know how long I could go without breathing, and I had to be getting closer to my limit. So I waited until the stars were out, and I could hear snoring, and I left. I wished I had a bag to pack, but there was nothing for me to bring. I barely owned my own skin. The outside air, it smelled like freedom, and my breath came easier for a moment. Then I learned. It turns out there's lots of things in the world just like those footsteps. It turns out there's lots of things that make you hold your breath. But at least I got to choose where I took my last.
I'm Joanna LaForgia, and this is Crank, by Arthur Carlove. Jimmy has no arms, see? Never had any. Was born like this. Almost every baby born after the war is missing parts. Some don't have limbs, like Jimmy. Some have bits of the face missing. Some lack internal organs. Those are the lucky ones. They don't live too long after the cord is cut. Less suffering. Jimmy, well, not so lucky. His mother left him with us and took off as soon as she could walk after the birth. Said she would look for supplies and come back. Said she knew where to find a good stash. We have never seen her again. Maybe she crossed the border. Maybe she got shot trying to cross the border. Nobody knows. I know she is not coming back. So we raised Jimmy, just like we raised every other kid that was left here with us, just like every other kid that will only remember the four walls of the shelter and the ever-gray sky poking through the holes in the roof. We taught these kids all we could remember. Most of the books were destroyed in war. They prefer visuals anyway, like moving visuals with sound. We have some old laptops that still work. Hardware is not the problem. Power is the problem. Most batteries were completely fried unless your stuff was in the basement. In that case, they were almost completely fried. Still good for a few minutes, but that's it. I sit Jimmy up, back against the wall, put the computer up on a cinder block, sit down beside him, grab a hand crank battery charger, and get cranking. In a minute or two, the screen lights up, and I could pick something to show Jimmy. We watch old heroes saving Earth over and over. We watch animals long extinct, frolicking like nothing could ever happen to them. We watch lovers falling out, and mortal enemies become dearest friends. We watch regular people do their jobs with the skill and efficiency of finely tuned machines. And we watch machines built by those people, in turn, outperform their creators. And then we watch about war. Not the last one, of course. There will not be a film about the last war, at least not for a long time. Jimmy was scared at first, but I explained to him why this is important, and he gets it. He forgets to exhale sometimes when we watch this. I have to remind him to breathe. He smiles and corrects his breathing pattern. The showtime is over. Scavengers return with food, mostly. Some overgrown mushrooms, oblong berries with pulsating veins and a subtle glow. Devil's dicks, we call them. A few rat corpses and a two-headed rabbit. None of the food is healthy in any sense of the word. But the choice between a slow, painful, certain death of starvation and a slower, less painful, and less certain death of slow poisoning is obvious. As we sit down to eat, I think to myself, here we are, a bunch of broken scavengers, a kid with no arms, an old laptop with a drive full of random relics, a hand crank, and me, the human battery. It's like we are trying to crank start a civilization. Sometimes I wonder just how human it will be, because the last one sure wasn't.
My name is Dennis Corcoran. I am reading a story by Kurt Hunt titled, In the End, the World Will Break Your Heart. On the second to last day before the end of the world, I went to work. I sat through four conference calls, only one of which required me to speak, and took a nap in a bathroom stall. I hated myself that day, and when I got home, Alex was pissed off that I left laundry to mildew in the washer, and Sam was whining about climbing trees. Why can't I? I'm eight. And I might have hated them a little bit, too. Such a waste, that hate. I see that now. On the day before the end of the world, the day we learned of the accident, the day we first heard the word ecophagy, we panicked and did nonsensical things. Sam locked the doors and started carrying a wiffle bat everywhere to protect you. Well, what about Mom? I asked. But he just rolled his eyes. That's my boy, said Alex, somehow smiling, while filling containers with clean water and gathering batteries. I went outside. Birds clamored. Sirens sang out in rounds. And I paced and paced and left voicemails for people I'd never see again. My brother, to apologize for tipping Dad off about his pot seeds when I was nine. My boss, to let her know I wasn't coming in. My mom, whose dementia had long ago ferried her from us. Once the adrenaline spat us out, we watched hour after hour of live TV, allowing the sounds and images to slowly chip away at our disbelief. The feed switched every few minutes, automated, I guessed, by some conscientious tech on his way out the door. There were no graphics or announcers or explanations, only raw video, sounds unedited,
An occasional satellite view showed the gray spreading like a cataract. We watched some African cities succumb. Maybe Lagos? Alec asked. And the question hit me like a fist, because all I could think was that it had probably been around for hundreds or thousands of years. But this was the first time I'd ever seen it, or even really thought about it. It looked crowded, but that thought led to thinking about people, which led to imagining. I hit the power button and jumped off the couch. Let's play 20 questions, I said. Sam, go first. Okay, I'm thinking of an animal. The answer turned out to be zebra. Once we guessed it, Sam asked if the thing on the news meant all the zebras were dead. Alex held Sam on her lap, squeezing him as if he were in danger of floating away. And she said, maybe not yet, but they probably would soon be. She believes in honesty, even hard truths, but she cried for him while she said it. Sam looked at me for reassurance, but I was thin on fatherly wisdom even on the best days, so I changed the subject. Do you know, when I met your mom, she couldn't look me in the eye? Alex laughed her raucous laugh and called me a liar and reminded me that she had approached me when she worked at the movie theater because she thought I had been injured, but it turned out I was just sobbing at the end of Titanic. Sam listened for a while, then wriggled off Alex's lap and said he was going to use the neighbor's trampoline because sitting around and talking was a waste of his time. Alex and I stayed together on the couch, fingers interlocked. But even as we cited trivial reassurances, I felt everything just dissipate. Peace woke me, heart pounding, in the middle of the night. The power had failed and taken all the buzzing background noise with it. It took several minutes of lying in the dark, petting Alex's hair and feeling my pulse throb before I realized it wasn't just the refrigerator or the sounds from the TV. The sirens had stopped. The birds were silent. Today the world ends. We asked Sam, if you could do anything today, anything at all, what would it be? So here we are at the nature preserve, surrounded by good climbing trees. Only a 10-minute drive from home, but the things we passed. Now Alex and I sit together on the overlook. Our feet dangle over the gorge, sometimes playfully hooking together as we watch the horizon blanch to a single gray hue. Like a storm front, it sweeps over the distant cluster of the skyscrapers and across the river into the suburbs. I thought we'd grow old together, I'd say. Ah. She leans her head against my shoulder. That's really cliche. Besides, we'd have just sat around watching the weather, just like this. The wind picks up a sudden acetic odor. A voice in the distance shouts incomprehensible, angry syllables. Well, not just like this. Here goes nothing, Sam says, something he picked up from a movie, as he sprints to the base of a maple growing at the edge of the drop-off and climbs. Alex is crying. Me too. We both want nothing more than to hold him close, to be all together in this moment. But he's fearless up there and joyful, and it's where he wants to be, so we're content to hold each other and watch. From 20 feet up, he waves at us and shouts, I love you! We shout back and smile, despite everything. Then he stands on a branch, slowly releasing his grip on the rough bark of the trunk, and takes a step. For a moment, just a moment, as he raises his arms for balance, something in the angle of his shoulders hints at manhood, but it's gone even before I recognize it. Instead, we see his smile broad and unrestrained, and we watch him walk, and I ignore the way my heart lurches every time he sticks out too far or slips a little. It is beautiful, and it is terrible. because we know he will never fall.
Hello, this is Carrie Lawson, and this is The Sacrifice by Kevin J. Anderson. The foul-smelling mist exhaled from the cave opening, a swirl of brimstone and smoke. A soft reptilian growl echoed, low and steady. The dragon was still sleeping, but when he awakened, he would be hungry. The young woman, the virgin sacrifice, struggled against the ropes that bound her to the stake. Her wrists were already raw, but she couldn't get away. She waited for the monster to emerge, to devour her. The charred bones strewn about the lair, crushed skulls, cracked femurs, drained of marrow, curved rib cages gave evidence of previous meals that had not satisfied the beast. She tried to be strong, straining and grasping against the bonds, but she didn't dare twist too hard, because that might make her wrists bleed, and blood would certainly draw the dragon. A tear stole aimlessly down her cheek, but she forced herself not to whimper. The fear, too, would bring him out. Months ago, the dragon had awakened from its ancient slumber and terrorized the countryside. With broad razor wings, it swooped down on the shepherds' flocks, roasting sheep and leaving charred fields. It attacked the villagers next, setting thatched roofs on fire, burning cottages to the ground, and feasting on any victims it could seize. When the priests consulted their holy text and knew there could be only one solution to appease the dragon, a virgin sacrifice, a pure young woman offered up to keep the beast at bay. And the townspeople, her own people, had turned on her. They chose her because she was the least important, an orphan with no one to speak on her behalf. Though she was pretty, kind, and well-loved, she had no dowry and was not likely to find a husband anyway. She had no say in the matter. Now she was tied to the stake before the lair, waiting, doomed, sure the dragon would soon emerge, a nightmare of scales and fangs and deadly fire. And it would see her there, a sacrifice. But all she could think of was the brave knight and his kisses, his reassurances, how he had held her the night before. It was their secret. None of the villagers suspected. But she wondered if the dragon would know.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrood, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.